Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 404th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor, and I'm the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta, but that's not a big deal because we have a full-time professor in the studio with us. Dr. Koronik.
Well, I'm an associate professor, just to be clear, but thank you, Dr. Allen. My name is Tina, and I am in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Alberta here and the director of the peer group.
And we're going to tackle a topic that I don't think, Mike, you and I have done in the sort of 400-plus episodes of our podcast, and it's to do with the highly publicized, I think you would agree with me, the opioid use disorder issue.
Yes, I would say it's relatively big now. Mm-hmm. And we have not dealt with it. We've talked about opioids for the treatment of pain in the past. Sure. But we haven't dealt with it as a disease itself. And I think that's been a bit remiss, but as things have gotten more and more important in the last probably 5 years, what happened was we were asked as the peer group, this is about 2 years ago, can we do anything to be involved? And we listed a bunch of things, the KT kind of stuff we do, and one of them was a guideline and that kind of thing. And Tina said, I would love to lead that work.
Yeah. That's exactly what I said.
Yeah. And so we're not actually going to maybe do that a little bit later for the actual guideline, but for these next,
pieces.
Yeah. We're going to just talk about a couple of tools for practice that you guys have put together in the last, couple of 3 months.
Right. And so I think, and Tina, you can jump in here anytime, but one of the big questions we had is how do you even identify someone with opioid use disorder? We see patients all the time who are using opioids for chronic pain or requesting opioids for chronic pain. And sometimes the pain is hard to determine because you can't identify a true, like an easy to identify pathological cause, but there's a complaint of significant pain, et cetera. And so how do you discern when a patient, even a patient who has the intention of using it for pain, has drifted into opioid use disorder?
Yeah, Mike, I'll add in, I think this is one of the biggest questions I see any conference I attend. This is the question that comes up, especially in primary care. Yeah. I've been to conferences where the clinicians say, well, I don't have anyone with opioid use disorder. I just have a lot of people with really poorly controlled pain. And so that question of how do we pick up the people who actually have this is such a relevant question to primary care. Now, if you ask anyone who deals with this all the time, they'll say, oh, it's easy. But for those of us working in the generalist clinic, it's not always as easy.
Yeah, it's not quite as easy as flushing ears, I can tell you that much. So let's talk about this a little bit more. So Joey Tan, who's a member of both the College of Family Physicians of Canada and a member of PEER, he and I embarked on handling this one. And we did we approached it like a systematic review. So the next ones we're going to talk about, the next three tools for practice, the Tina will deal with two of them. They're handled a little bit more intensely than the average tools for practice. We're pretty rigid when we do a tools for practice, but this one, these are all systematic reviews. And so we searched the literature through a variety of mechanisms. We went to Medline or PubMed, if you like, and we identified 1,309 articles. We went to Cochrane, identified 184 articles. Then what happens when you find the articles that you think are relevant, you search the references and we got another 889. When you remove duplicates, you're left with well over 2,000 articles. So we looked hard to try and find articles that are systematic reviews that spoke to the issue of making the diagnosis, or first of all, screening, identifying patients through screening a kind of a case finding, because you're not going to screen everybody in your practice for opioid use disorder. You're going to screen those who are using opioids or may have problems with dependence. And so what we did is we looked at systematic reviews. We found 14 that were relevant. And, you know, when you're looking at these aren't RCTs. That you're not, when you're looking at diagnostic studies, you're not looking at randomized controlled trials. You're looking for cohort studies where what they do is they take a bunch of people who may have the condition in question, run them through a screening maneuver, and then apply a gold standard at the end of that to determine how good the screening tool that you're using is at identifying the condition. So how good are they at identifying opioid use disorder?
And Mike, I was going to add in, it's not a big deal. I mean, you know, we've always, for those of you guys who followed the podcast, we've always put RCTs at the top. But for identifying this or answering this particular question, you don't actually do an RCT first. The whole purpose is that you, so this is the highest level of evidence when you're trying to come up with some sort of a diagnostic tool. Now, you may later on go and say, you could do an RCT of that diagnostic tool to see if it actually is any better than doing nothing or other tools. But this is the highest level to at least to, create the tool, if you will.
Yes, exactly. And the vast majority of our research on diagnostic tools are derived from this. So whether it's auscultation of lungs for respiratory tract infection, you know, whether it's an ultrasound of the abdomen for fatty liver, whatever, the tools that we use, the foundations of our diagnostic tools, what's sensitivity, specificity, all of that is based in these cohort diagnostic studies. So know that even though these aren't RCTs, they're still the best available and reasonable evidence to address these questions. And understand, this is, for those of you who do a little evidence-based medicine, this stuff is more complicated because you're looking at what are the cutoffs used for these new scoring systems, because that will, of course, change the sensitivity and specificity. You want to know how long will this questionnaire take? How hard is it to use in primary care? Because obviously, if it had, let's say, if it was physician administered and it took 70 questions, that's never going to be used by primary care clinicians. And so there's a lot of things that kind of go into the thinking around what's the utility of this tool. And then probably one of the linchpins, just like allocation, concealment, and randomization are the things in RCTs, what you want to know in diagnostic studies is what was the gold standard that they used? And I can tell you right now, this is exactly where the research for screening tools in opioid use disorder falls apart. Yeah. The use of the gold standard was all over the map. It was just highly inconsistent. So we identified 14 systematic reviews. They had anywhere from 6 to 50 different diagnostic studies. They examined 16 different tools, and they used 23 different gold standards. So that should tell you right off the hop that the medical literature around opioid use disorder is not doing well.
Yeah, it's just a as they say, it's a dog's breakfast.
It's a dog's breakfast that has been left a couple of years under the hot sun.
Isn't it interesting though? This I found this shocking because we are told so clearly when you look at guidelines, the gold standard is DSM. 5 or 4. But in the research literature, you don't see that at all. It's just shocking, actually.
Yeah, we were shocked to read. We won't get into that in this one, but just the gold standard itself within clinicians who do addiction medicine, there is great debate about even the DSM, whether it should. And they debate the language that's used. Is it dependence? Is it addiction? Is it what have you? There's huge debate in the literature around that, and it is fascinating to know that it's so great when you go to a lecture and they're telling you, just as Tina indicated, it's so easy to identify patients with opioid use disorder, et cetera. But if you actually look in the literature, they can't decide not only on how to identify them, but what even makes up opioid use disorder. So it was a gong show. But the good news is we did get some reasonable evidence for you. So we focused on, just as Tina indicated, the DSM-4 and 5. Interestingly, 4 is written as Roman numerals and 5 is alphanumeric. So I understand why that changed. Maybe they thought we were losing our touch with Roman numerals. I'm not sure. But there's two main tools that were identified. One was called the Prescription Opioid Misuse Index. It has 6 questions in it. And the other one was the CALM tool, which is the current opioid misuse measure. And it had 17 questions. So you can see why we mentioned the POMI first, because, or POMI first, because it's much briefer. Yeah. So,
and it don't want to spoil anything. It may or may not be better.
Right. So let's talk about that. May or may not be better. Right. So let's talk about the POMI tool. So it's 6 questions, and you have to get more, at least 2 or more, to be considered at risk for opioid use disorder, or being someone who's at risk for opioid use disorder. Let's quickly go over those 6 questions. Now, all you have to do is go to the Tools for Practice, and it's enclosed at the end of the Tools for Practice. And we did actually contact the primary author and ask for if we had her permission to include that list of 6 questions, which we did. So here they are. Do you ever use more of your medication, i.e. take a higher dose than you were prescribed?
Yes.
That's
I thought you were asking me the question.
Yeah. But that's, James, we're not going over your sildenafil abuse.
Oh.
Okay, so do you ever use your medication more often, i.e. shorten the time between doses, than you were prescribed? Do you ever need early refills of your pain medication? That was number 3. Number 4, do you ever feel high or get a buzz when using your pain medication? Number 5 was, do you ever take your pain medication because you are upset, using the medication to relieve or cope with problems other than pain? And number 6 is, have you ever gone to multiple physicians, including the emergency room doctor, seeking out more of your pain medication?
There's only 6 questions. They're fairly simple, relatively speaking, and they get, for lack of a better way of saying it, get to the heart of the matter with that. So it's a pretty simple.
It's beautiful. Yeah. It's simple.
Well, it reflects the DSM-4-5. It's just a shorter. It's just cutting out some of the questions, but
right.
So
how well did it work on the cohort that was actually the patients that we cared about, the ones actually using an opioid, and this survey was done to them and then compared to the gold standard. It was 74 patients. So there's a whole bunch of different ways to measure this. One of them is something called the area under the curve, and that's kind of the one that takes into account all of the sensitivity and specificity. And that was somewhere between 0.75 and 0.8. And James, I think you'd agree that that's, or sorry, it was point,
that's right.
It was 0.89. Sorry, it was 0.89.
Yeah.
And most cardiovascular risk calculators are 0.75 to 0.8. So being 0.89 as an area under the curve is pretty good.
Yeah. And just so the closer you get to one, the better.
Right.
Is what you're looking for, you know, a perfect, and I'm probably going to use the word wrong, but correlation or with that. But it has some predictive ability, I think, is what you can say.
Yeah, it's pretty good. So let's talk about, for those EBM people in the audience, they will know things like likelihood ratio. So let's talk about that. So the positive likelihood ratio is 10.3. And most people will know who care about this kind of stuff, that the likelihood ratio of 10 and above indicates that it's a large help in ruling in a diagnosis.
Yeah. And what I want to add is, just because you know how big of a fan I am and of things like large help and moderate help, and we'll get into that in a minute. So, but like a positive likelihood ratio of 10 is that's pretty good, relatively speaking, when you see likelihood ratios. But here's a number that you can sort of hang your hat on, is that let's say you had a person who you were going, you know, you had a initial thought that, you know, maybe there's a 20% chance that this person has opioid use disorder. If they test positive in this on this questionnaire, that increases your likelihood, the chance that they have it, by about 45%, and that's an absolute number. So if it was a 20 before, and you do this questionnaire, and it comes out positive, you're now, it's sort of two-thirds likely that they have a opioid use disorder. So it's kind of which I think most people, as you said, Mike, is a what they call a large help in ruling in.
Right. And so for if you're a person who still uses specificity, it's 0.92 or 92%. The negative likelihood ratio is the one where you're trying to rule something out, so exclude something. It's not great, but it's still reasonable. It's 0.2. Yeah. That is called a moderate help.
And I find it much more useful, because a lot of people don't, they understand the concept of likelihood ratios. But in this case, a 0.2 means you can reduce the chance that they have an opioid use disorder by about 30%. So if you have a patient in front of you who you're kind of going, I'm not sure if they do or not, and it's, you know, you think maybe 20 or 30% chance, if this questionnaire is negative, it doesn't completely rule it out, but it reduces it by about 30%. So if you're not really highly suspecting a opioid use disorder, it does effectively rule it out, depending on where you are in the first place.
Right. And if you're super keen on that kind of actually applying it, using the online tools and graphics and stuff, you just have to search the word Fagan nomogram, mm-hmm. Fagan nomogram. And there's online calculators where you think this patient has a 30% chance of having opioid use disorder. You plug in these numbers and it'll tell you exactly what their risk is, the best estimate of their risk is afterwards. And the sensitivity was 0.82. So that's that tool. And I think when you look at those numbers and you look at the simplicity of it and the fact that it's compared to the gold standard, that's why we thought it was probably the best of the bunch.
Yeah. And if we actually saw it, sorry, go ahead, Tina.
Okay, I was going to say the one other thing we thought was interesting from a primary care perspective, although we certainly will deal with patients who are addicted to heroin and other issues, a lot of primary care docs say, well, I don't see those kind of patients. But this study was done on patients who were simply prescribed oxycodone for pain. So we thought the population was really, most primary care docs can at least get on board with saying, yeah, okay, I do see those patients. So it's sort of in that population, which we thought was reasonable too.
Yeah. And I was going to say, add in, you know, there might be other sort of questionnaires that come out, but it would be tough to get much better than this.
So simple.
Yeah. Even the numbers, the likelihood ratios and stuff, these are fairly impressive likelihood ratios. And I think it has to do with quite clearly, I mean, the questions are quite good in that, you know, if you are doing a couple of these things, you likely do have an issue.
You know?
Yeah.
So knowing that this one has pretty good numbers, the right patients, the right size of questionnaire, and the right gold standard, let's move on to the next one, which is close, and that's the CALM, the current opioid misuse measure. It is a 40-point scale derived from 17 questions, and the cutoff generally used is somewhere around 13 points. Out on that score of 40 is suggestive of a potential opioid use disorder. The cohort study that we're talking about here was 238 patients prescribed an opioid in the last 12 months. And we're not going to go over that one because it's obviously a lot more questions, etc. And it's not quite as effective as you'll see here. So the area under the curve here is 0.84, so not quite as good as the last one. The positive likelihood ratio is only 3.4 or so. So it really offers small help in ruling in or out.
And again, that adds another 20%. So the previous one adds about 45% absolute predictability, whereas this only adds about 20%. So it is, I think, clinically different, if you will.
Yeah, not nearly as helpful.
Yeah.
Specificity is 0.77. The negative likelihood ratio is 0.3. And remember, the lower you go, the better. So it's not as good as the last one either. And the sensitivity is 0.77. So really not, you know, not a lot of great things. The right patients for sure and the right gold standard, but a longer questionnaire and with less impressive numbers, which is really the most important thing. So these are all based on small studies, which is unfortunate, but we just don't have a lot of great repeat data using the right gold standard, et cetera. There are a ton of other tools out there. As we mentioned earlier, there's 16 that we identified. Many of them, most of them weren't compared to the right gold standard. Many of them were really long. There's one called the SOAP and the SOAP R, which is too long of questionnaires. Many of them are just weak in their predictive ability. There's one called the PDUQP. And some of them are studied in opioid use disorder patient population, like the CAGE-8 survey. So there's a lot of surveys out there. There's even more gold standards, which is crazy on the face of it. And there's just not a lot of great tools out there that we could point to.
Yeah. And I was going to say, Mike, this is, you know, on the scheme of how you look at tools that look at this sort of thing, we're very much in the infancy of, do these tools even make a difference? I mean, just getting an idea of a tool that works, then you test it in another population to see if it works, and then you go beyond that and go, what if we even randomize people in a different settings to use this tool or not to see if it makes an impact? We're still very much in the infancy stage of whether or not this is a tool that it is useful in clinical practice.
Right.
Well, yeah, isn't that interesting? In the midst of this opioid crisis, we're still struggling with a tool on how to diagnose it.
Yeah, how to catch people and diagnose it.
Like, yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's remarkable, and we're debating, you know, saying things like people talking about measures of counting how many family doctors are using Suboxone, prescribing Suboxone when, and I know that's a trade name, by the way, but, and when really the question is, how do we even figure out who's a problem in our clinic? Yeah. Who has this problem? Who's at risk?
And so can I ask you guys, I mean, obviously before you did this tools for practice, you had people who you believed to have opioid use disorder. And I don't want to put you guys too much on the spot, but what did you do before? Was it sort of a gut feeling?
Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, this is a difficult conversation to have with some patients. Some of them really confront it with frustration and anger because they feel pain. And they feel you know, if you tell someone that you've become dependent on a substance, it means all sorts of things. They're an addict and all of that kind of negative. They're weak and therefore can fall prey to these. So the whole thing is obviously very, very tricky and needs to be handled with nuance. But then you'll also have patients in your practice, and I know Tina has these as well, where I've you know, thought, oh man, I guess I've got to confront them and talk about this. And finally, you get the courage, you think you have enough time in the appointment, you say, are you concerned that you might have developed a dependence on this substance? And they'll be, yes, absolutely, I'm dependent on it. You're like, man, am I ever an idiot for not addressing this earlier. So it's all kinds where patients are enraged at you to like, man, doctor, you're dumb for not. This is obviously I'm dependent on it.
Yeah.
So
it's so tricky, and I will admit I've never officially done the DSM-4 or 5 on a patient who I suspected. I used to be a psychiatry resident, so I should be very familiar with that book, but I haven't pulled it out in a while. But it is, yeah, it's been more of a gut feeling, a sense of how they're presenting and how much they're needing. So in some ways, I do think having even a brief tool like this is helpful to sort of present the sort of objective evidence to your patients and say, you know what, I think there's something else going on here.
Yeah. And you could literally almost say, you don't have to shorten it much, but you could even just look through these. And if you just, even off the top of your head, if you could just remember a couple of the questions, And and if you ask them, and all those, you know, you ask the first one, you get a yes, and then the other one, you go, oh, yeah, maybe yes as well. You know, you're already there. You've already got a something that's taking you from maybe say a 20% chance that they have an opioid use disorder upwards of, you know, like I said, a 2/3 chance. So, you know, it's very impressive in its simplicity. Unfortunately, it hasn't been, you know, completely perfected.
Hasn't been validated.
Validated and all that sort of stuff.
Been extensively studied. Let's talk about the last pieces, which I think are important. So DSM-4 and 5 criteria for opioid use disorder may be met by patients with chronic pain because they have features like tolerance, withdrawal, and unsuccessful efforts to cut down because they try and cut down, but they're in agony, so they return to their old dose, etc. So you have to take that into context. And that's one of the reasons why people have said maybe the DSM is the poor choice. But right now it is considered as the tool. We just have to recognize that those can't be, those are excluded from the evaluation for patients in long-term opioid therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a real, that's another sort of interesting area of discussion because, certain patients with chronic pain, you can't really use the DSM-5 on them, but then how are you diagnosing them? And actually, James, I don't know if you mentioned this before, the BC Center on Substance Use has some great resources online, but they have the DSM-5 criteria are pretty easy to locate on their website.
Right.
And it's interesting to take a look at, but it does raise a question in patients with chronic pain. How useful is it?
Yeah, and also fundamentally different with what you're going to do, because if you've got just an opioid use disorder and, you know, maybe not even a legitimate chronic pain, that's completely different than a person with a legitimate chronic pain, like exactly as you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it gets very tricky. So if we were to do this tool and then you suspect opioid use disorder, there's a few things that potentially you can do after that. I mean, there's no point in doing this if we didn't have anything we could do. And we will get a little bit to that right in the next podcast, Mike or Tina. I think that's the plan.
Yes, that is the plan.
Sounds good.
Tina's going to take us through those the next time we get on board with this. And I will say the one last thing is there is some work being done right now on population screening tools that actually use the electronic record to identify things. But the vast majority of those studies have used exceptionally poor gold standards in the past. And therefore, we don't really know how they'll work. So it's better to think of case finding in your practice with the patients you meet on the day, and you're wondering, could this patient have opioid use disorder? We recommend the Palm Eye tool or Palmy tool as a really simple tool to help identify patients. And remember, it's the tool is strongest in identifying. So if it's positive, there's a relatively good chance that it is positive. Yeah. Or do something crazy like your clinical judgment, which is often an excellent tool in practice. Yeah,
because like I said, like you've said before, none of these definitely, you know, 100% rule in, 100% rule out. So that's
right.
You know, and the great thing about this particular tool is the numbers are pretty impressive. It given that it hasn't been, you know, relooked at or validated to any important degree, but it's relatively simple.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I think we've beaten this one to death, relatively speaking, which is always a good thing, I think. So just a couple of announcements, at least one for me. So our course, we've got all of our speakers put together. We will be opening registration for the course in the next probably week and a little bit. So go to our website, certainly no later than the end of January, we'll have registration up. And I think we've got lots of good speakers, lots of good topics. In fact, this topic will also be presented. I think, Tina, you're going to do an awesome job of presenting a lot of this information at the course, which, if you're wondering, is in Vancouver, May 3 and May 4. So even though you may not have registered yet, put that date aside. Mike, anything from you guys or Tina?
Nothing at the present time.
Nope.
Nothing to sell. So if that's the case, then I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.